Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
Tuesday, the 7th of October. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the show, friends. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So it's been a week since Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gathered hundreds of America's top military generals and officers in Quantico, Virginia, for a talk on military culture. His focus was the so-called warrior ethos, and he made it very clear that he wants to raise the physical fitness and grooming standards. No more beards. He also wants to curb DEI and make standards for combat positions gender neutral. By the way, they've already been gender neutral. And he said that with these raised standards, if some people don't make it, including women, so be it. Now that the dust has settled, today on the show, we're going to hear from three individuals who served in the military, climbing its ranks, to help us unpack what was said, get their take on this culture shift. We'll also ask, is it necessary? Was it necessary? And how will it help America maintain its position as the world's most lethal military force? We'll also get their take on President Donald Trump's suggestion that the military be used in American cities and to use those so-called dangerous cities as training grounds. Of course, our show is driven by you, our listeners, at home, on the road, and elsewhere. So we invite you to participate in the conversation. Our question of the day is, does the U.S. military need to reform its culture and standards? And we are very interested in hearing from veterans and their families. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, please share the video, but also leave your comments in the chat.
And just highlighting what you said there, we really are interested in hearing from folks who are veterans, who've grown up in military families, because a lot of us on the outside don't really have a great sense of what military culture is, and your perspective would be invaluable today. So give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. Trio of local news stories. Yep. Cherry, let's start it off. We mentioned this yesterday on the show, but local governments and organizations are starting to feel the pain as Pennsylvania's budget impasse enters its fourth month. Here in our area, the Philadelphia Center Against Sexual Violence announced it will begin laying off staff today and that some of its services, including its 24/7 crisis hotline, will go dark starting Friday. Those calls will be rerouted to a national hotline. And last week, Spotlight PA reported that three counties already have plans to furlough workers, including Northampton County in the Lehigh Valley. So we're starting to see some of the effects from this ongoing budget stalemate in Harrisburg.
Yeah, it's a really sad moment for WAR that has been doing this work for many years.
And that's, by the way, the former name of the Philadelphia Center Against Sexual Violence.
Yes, as well as for about 2,500 people who work for domestic violence organizations throughout the state. And many of these groups are at serious risk of layoffs because those programs are funded by $11 million from the state. And counties have already said that, look, they cannot continue to front the money to keep these organizations open, you know, and many of the groups just cannot afford to take advantage of the state loan program because there's a 4.5% interest rate on that. And so they're already on thin budgets. But, you know, it also makes me wonder how many other types of organizations will start feeling the brunt of this. And we talked about this on the show yesterday. Once these organizations, once all parts of the state start feeling the pain of this budget impasse, it will turn up the pressure on the lawmakers to make a deal.
Yeah, it probably will, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's how you, when constituents get angry, sometimes things get done. But it still stuns me that we're at this place with this particular budget, given that the baseline, the context is not what you would usually see when there's a budget impasse. Typically, budget impasses emerge out of like extreme need in state budgets, you know, pending, you know, deficits, things like that. There's a structural deficit here in Pennsylvania, but not the threat of going into the red this year. And so it's amazing that we're still at this place, given that there's money in the coffers.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll probably start feeling it more. I remember when SEPTA was the big issue.
Yeah, but then they
and we felt that, and then they moved that. And so, yeah. Second story, Philadelphia taxpayers are footing the bill for one-way bus tickets for houseless individuals. It's part of the city's Stranded Traveler Assistance Program, which some advocates have said you know, one of the fixes to homelessness, right? NBC 10 investigative reporter Claudia Vargas did a really interesting deep dive into the program. And what they found is that between July of 2021 through May of this year, the city paid for about 875 one-way tickets out of Philadelphia to about 276 cities across the country. And it cost taxpayers about $270,000. And the farthest trip was to San Jose, California. But most people got these free tickets to go to places like Harrisburg or other areas along the East Coast. And the barriers to get these tickets are pretty low. All you have to do is have somebody on the other side willing to take you in. They check the sex offender registry, but other than that, they don't run any type of background checks. But, you know, it's a big deal because it helps people get to places where they have support. And on any given night, Avi, the city has about 5,000 people who are without homes, and they could be, you know, couch surfing. They could be, you know, in shelters, or they could be sleeping outside.
Well, you hope it helps people get to places where they have support. But what the NBC 10 report revealed is that there's really no groundwork to make sure that's actually happening. Yeah. And they profiled a man who was going to Florida, who seemingly had no contacts in Florida, and then, according to the reporting, returned to Philadelphia. So, you know, it's a tough one because the idea, right, of the program is to make it easy and simple. You don't want to lard it down with a bunch of sort of unnecessary red tape, but then you really don't know if it works.
Yeah.
And you don't know if you're just sort of moving this problem around. By the way, Philadelphia, what makes Philadelphia's program different is that the city government is paying for these bus tickets, but there are organizations that do this all over the country.
Nonprofits usually. Yeah.
All over the country. With different motives, some with genuine concern, some just trying to get people out of town. It was really interesting. If you watch the NBC 10 report, they interview the government official who's running the program, and he just happens to have a sign on his desk that says, "Don't let perfect be the enemy of good." And if that isn't the ethos
of
a
program
like this, I mean, it's just like one of those visual moments that really popped for me in the story, which is a good one and people should check it out.
Yeah. And by the way, part of the problem is they do zero follow up. So you don't know. And some of the people do end up right back in Philly.
Of course, follow up costs money and sometimes it slows programs down. I mean, I think this is genuinely one of those things that gets to the tension of what it's like to run a government program and try to run it with
as
the
maximum
impact. Right. So third story, man, I don't know what to think about this one, Cherry. I really don't. So I learned today about a young man named Andrew Perong. His life's work is to end robocalls. Andrew's 28 years old. He's from our region. He's a graduate of Temple Law. He has been suing robocallers since high school. And that's like dozens of lawsuits against robocallers because there's a federal law that says you can't call certain people if they're on like a do not call list. He has been accused of actually trying to entrap robocallers so that he can file these lawsuits so that he can make money. That's a little tangent. But the recent news about Andrew is that he tried to sue a major leader in the Pennsylvania legislature, Democratic leader, who had done some robocalls to inform constituents about various upcoming events and services. He got his case all the way to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals right here in Philadelphia, big court, and he did lose.
Yep.
So this is the first of its kind case that basically says certain government officials are exempt from those anti-robocall call laws under certain circumstances. So there's Andrew. He's been doing this for at least 10 years, setting precedent here in the United States. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to hug him or if he would, if
don't you can't definitely can't call him and ask him for
no, I know. I was like, should I call him and ask him for comment? I don't know. It's dangerous.
Can't leave a message.
What do you, I mean, what did you think about this guy's crusade against robocalls?
I thought it was interesting. And by the way, I got a robocall last night from my congressman telling me about a town hall.
Did you pick up?
I did not, but I got the voicemail. But, you know, I could see why the court decided to exclude government officials because that's for the public good. And so, but Andrew, I mean, he was like, Perong was like, look, I don't want anybody calling me who I didn't say call me.
Yeah.
And there are probably people who feel like that, but there's a difference between, you know, people trying to solicit you for a campaign, for example, and this. But I want to give him some advice because there's a lot of money being made against the spam text right now. Someone just got millions of dollars from Cash App.
You're saying he should shift his focus to the text.
Focus to the text.
That's
man.
Smart.
Yeah, that's where the money, money. Is. Yeah. That's big money. So you're welcome.
You are welcome, Andrew, by the way. Please don't sue us. But also, I do think that robocalls really, to me, are not as big an issue anymore.
No,
I don't know.
No.
I think
he started this in high school.
He did. I get it.
Admit
I get it.
That was like
it's his thing
ago.
And he can't stop. But I do feel like it's actually very easy now to tell.
Yeah.
I haven't actually picked up a robocall in earnest in like years.
Yeah, thinking, that's what I'm saying. Andrew, switch to spam text.
Free advice.
Lots of money.
Free legal advice.
Switch over.
From Cherry Gregg Esquire. coming back on the other side of this break, we're going to talk about military culture and whether it needs to change. We would love to hear your thoughts. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth says the military needs a culture reboot. In a provocative speech last week, he made his case to a room full of senior military officials. The military, Hegseth argued, has grown too permissive, too preoccupied with diversity, and too distant from the warrior ethos that makes great fighters.
There are a couple ways to think about Hegseth's argument. First, we have to ask, is the analysis fair? Has this change taken place in the military, and has it led to adverse consequences? The second is whether his focus on culture, on military culture, is actually what the U.S. military needs to do right now, or should its focus be elsewhere? So we're going to pose those questions and more to our guests today, both of them military veterans. Elliot Ackerman is a Marine Corps veteran and New York Times best-selling author. Elliot, thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And Eric Stetson is a retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel. Eric, so nice to have you.
Thanks for the opportunity to share with you all. Thanks.
Wonderful. And we want to invite you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere, to participate in the conversation. Our question of the day is, does the U.S. military need to reform its culture and standards? And we're especially interested in hearing from veterans and their families. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop your comments in the chat.
So let's start with, I want to get a perspective from both of you on this, but I'm going to start with you, Elliot. We've had some time now to digest Hegseth's speech, and I'm curious what your big takeaways are.
I think my biggest takeaway was that the message was the medium, and the point of that speech was much more of a flex. You know, what he was delivering, the content of what he was delivering in terms of, you know, we need to focus on individual standards, we need to return to grooming. I mean, these, you know, standards, these are all messages that frankly usually aren't necessarily the purview of the Secretary of Defense. But the requirement that every flag officer, or virtually every flag officer, come to Quantico, Virginia, which happens at huge expense because these folks don't travel without their staffs. I mean, it happens in the context of what's now a government shutdown looming, was sort of a message that, you know, any dissent wouldn't be tolerated, that he was in charge. And I think that, more than anything else, was the purpose of the speech last week.
Your reactions, Eric Stetson.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that the military has to focus. It's not an either or. I think it's they need to focus on the culture and the warfighting ethos and the other priorities. You know, I agree with Elliot to the extent that I probably would have chosen a different methodology for delivering the message, notwithstanding what I don't know. And what we don't know happened there with that assembly of flag, you know, great officers, where other forums happen, communications, discussions, collaboration sessions. I don't know. But in general, you know, best practice and technique, as Elliot wrote very well in a piece last week in the Free Press, is normally going down to the formation, out to the formation to deliver the message. And, you know, usually in a town hall format, you know, Q&A, and then meeting other folks there at installations and locations and listening to them. it's probably what I would have chosen. Again, notwithstanding what I don't know else is going on at the highest, you know, echelons of our military.
So you agree that you sort of question the format here, but it sounds like there were things about the speech or the content of the speech that resonated with you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that, and I think, you know, Elliot has a lot more time in combat than I do. But I think he would agree, you know, standards are important. You know, physical fitness, skills, and standards are important to maintain. And there has been some slip there. You know, we can look at the weight of service members, you know, reports, various reports that are out there, up to 68% of our uniformed formation are clinically overweight or obese. And that is a problem for readiness. And so, you know, that and there's some other things going on that apparently the SecDef thought were a large enough issue that needed to be addressed. And I think you can reasonably argue what should be the number one focus for the SecDef and the Pentagon, of course. But I would argue that warfighting ethos and individual unit readiness is incredibly important, always important, and must always be one of the top priorities for the Pentagon and all the formations.
Yeah. And so I want to kind of get both of your takes on, you know, the idea that there have been a number of commanders in chief over the years, you know, the military. I mean, both of you spent time in the military. I know, Elliot, you spent a couple of decades in the military. And so, you know, you think about, you've probably seen presidents come, seen presidents go. How does this sort of, how do you feel the shift, the culture shift, as you get a new commander? Is this typical what you saw? How do things change across the top brass?
Sure. Which is correct. I spent 8 years on active duty as a special operator and also as an intelligence officer. I mean, the most concerning development that I have seen, you know, and I think Eric and I will agree, like height and weight standards, like those are all critically important issues. They are often more the purview of field grade officers, junior officers. I mean, yes, there are standards that get set across the services, you know, but the Secretary of Defense and the National Command Authority, you know, they're usually thinking in very big strategic terms. And there are a host of strategic issues facing the country right now, from the rise of China to our defense acquisition process. I mean, really big things outside the purview of kind of height and weight standards and beards. And I would say one of the really big strategic issues that's facing this country with our military right now is the continued trend, administration to administration, to politicize the U.S. military. And the Biden administration was guilty of this. I think you're seeing the Trump administration is now guilty of this. And if we enter that cycle where the military is politicized, you know, one of the most concerning things that Pete Hegseth did in his speech was to call out individual generals by name and say, these are not the types of officers who are welcome here. Because the second you start doing that, you start creating a view that there's a bias, that maybe certain generals and admirals are Republican generals and admirals, and others are Democratic generals and admirals. And you can take an institution like the U.S. military that has been viewed by and large as a non-political entity, and you can politicize it in the way that we've seen the Supreme Court politicize. And that undermines the credibility of the U.S. military in the eyes of American citizens. And in a democracy, having a large standing military combined with extremely dysfunctional domestic political politics is extremely dangerous. And this is something that our founding fathers understood. And I don't say this as a partisan of a Democrat or a Republican, but it is a road we seem to be rapidly traveling down. And that's very concerning.
And I'd love to get your take on that, Eric, because, the commanders in chief, they change.
Right.
And so did this feel different, you know, because, you know, as the sort of pendulum swings back and forth?
Well, I've never seen an occasion where a SecDef brought so many together at one point in time in one room to address it. And I think Elliot's exactly, you know, correct in terms of the military staying apolitical. And there's been a longstanding tradition of that, and it has slipped recently. I came into the service in the 90s, and so I saw the huge, you know, RIF reductions, and I also saw a climate created, it was called a zero defects army. in which stifled creativity, stifled calculated risk-taking. And we had to get rapidly away from that after 9/11, because so much of what happened after 9/11 was new for our military. We needed to learn how to reward calculated risk-taking instead. And so I've seen the pendulum swing from an attitudinal focus, both in administrations and inside the military, back and forth. I was in for 24 years. But I agree 100% with Elliot that it's critical the military stay apolitical as much as humanly possible and out of the fray. Some of the comments that I thought the secretary made was actually encouraging that and trying to say, hey, look, you focus on what you need to focus on. We have your back here. You know what needs to be done. You know the right answer. You know the best practices in maintaining unit cohesion and readiness and warfighting ethos. Yeah. Get on with it. And we'll take care of everything else.
Well, they were trying to remove the politics. Yeah.
To that point, this is one thing that Hex has said. We've weeded out so-called toxic leaders under the guise of double-blind psychology assessments, promoting risk-averse, go-along to get-along conformists instead. That Hex is saying that's what it was happening. You were saying that the military has tried to move away from that, from, I guess, promoting or emphasizing or otherwise coddling the risk averse. Yeah. So there's some confusion for me there. Yeah. Is military culture sort of to go along to get along, or was it and it changed?
So the change happened after 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, it was, you could see it because of the nature of the warfare we were involved with.
Yeah.
I left the service in 2015.
Yeah.
So I know what it was like when I left the service, how we trained people, what we did, etc. What most people had experienced. I think his assessment is there's been some erosion and some shift.
Yeah.
And he wants to take it back the other direction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's his assessment.
Why is that important, though? Because I guess the flip side of that, right, is that you promote people who are too risk-taking, but also just have maybe a toxic personality or not good leaders.
So the key phrase is calculated risk-taking and creativity.
Yeah.
We have to underwrite honest mistakes. We can't be a zero defects mentality. Otherwise, we stifle creativity and we stifle calculated risk-taking, and that freezes innovation and it freezes action. And we don't want that on the battlefield, and we don't want it in the formation.
Can you give me a sense? Maybe I'm just trying to get inside this real quick. Like a sense of someone being too risk-averse in a combat role.
Sure.
Maybe this is someone who's leading a unit. Like, how could that backfire in a way that endangers people?
Yeah, a friend of mine was a cavalry troop leader early in the war in 2003. Mm-hmm. And his soldiers were getting blown up by IEDs when they're soft-skinned vehicles. One of his NCOs came to him and said, hey, we can get local metal fabrication with local welders and weld that stuff onto our vehicles. I think we should do this. He said, go for it. Mm-hmm. So they started up armoring their own vehicles before the Pentagon had any kind of program.
Even though they didn't go up the chain of command.
They didn't go up the chain of command. They just got after it. When the commander
Problem solving.
Keeping people alive, adjusting, adapting, overcoming. When his commander found out about this, he was threatened with a court martial.
Mm. Mm.
2 weeks later, the entire unit was doing it. So that's just a quick example of why was he threatened with a court-martial versus you're fixing a problem to keep people alive and maintain flexibility. Just a quick example.
Yeah, interesting.
So it does go back and forth over time in the service with mentality and approach, and that is affected by the civilian decision-makers and policy-makers top-down, because everybody in the Army and in the military is subordinate to our civilian.
And it's a very top-down culture by design, right? I mean, I get your take on that, Elliot. How does that top-downness manifest in the military? And one thing I've been thinking about is, how is it different to be, let's say, fixing airplanes, being a mechanic in the military versus having that job in a civilian world? So these are both non-combat jobs, right? Neither of these people are on the front. But I wonder I'm trying to isolate how the culture of the military affects people, like how those two jobs might be different and how the top-downness comes into play.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the most obvious thing is there's a chain of command that extends all the way up to the President of the United States, who, in addition to being an elected leader, is also the Commander-in-Chief. And we have in this country a 250-year history of civilian leadership being the the pinnacle of our military leadership. So the obvious thing is that it's a military, it's hierarchical, people follow orders.
Yeah.
I think for those who are not in the military, what can surprise them at times is leadership is much more difficult than just barking orders. You know, I've had people sort of say to me, well, it must have been easy leading in the military. You just told people what to do and they did it.
No,
that's not how it works. You know, your credibility as a leader is wrapped up in the experiences you've had, your reputation. There are a million ways for people in uniform to not do or not do effectively what they're being asked if they don't believe in the mission. So the laws of sort of leadership and social gravity still exist in the military. And that, again, goes to the point of, you know, why it's so critically important that the culture of the military become apolitical. Because introducing politics into the military is you're introducing a sort of a toxic variable where, you know, if people view their commanders, start viewing their commanders through a political lens, you know, they may or may not be loyal to those commanders. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, like, you know, you crack open a history book and you look at other countries, we have been in our history the exception, not the norm. The norm is that politics gets introduced into the military.
Yeah.
You go all the way back to ancient times where there are cases, myriad cases of the soldiers deciding that their allegiance is to their general, not to the country. And, you know, we're having this conversation today, you know, in the context of National Guard troops being sent state to state in extremely political charged situations. And I, you know, I actually had an experience that myself when I came back from Iraq in 2005, my infantry battalion, the big event we participated in Iraq was the Second Battle of Fallujah, which was the biggest battle of that war. We came home and 6 months later, we were sent to New Orleans right after Hurricane Katrina. So within a 6 month period, we went from, you know, fighting Al-Qaeda in Iraq to helping provide security for the citizens of New Orleans. And that can be very disorienting for military members, you know, particularly when you see scenes like you see today where there's, you know, violence in the street and today National Guardsmen. But, you know, at other times there's been called for federal troops to be deployed to, you know, to keep the peace. And you're really playing with fire if you've got a politicized military that is being asked to get involved in not only domestic politics, but policing inside of cities. It is not good and does not take our country anywhere we want to go.
Yeah. And I want to, since you brought this up, Elliot, you know, I definitely want to, you know, touch on that because President Donald Trump has said, you know what, let's use our American, dangerous American cities as training grounds for our military. Mm-hmm. What has been the general rule, you know, Eric, as far as, you know, what it means, the way the military treats the American soil, what has been the view of soldiers on American soil, just so people who are not military affiliated understand.
Right. So I spent my whole time on active duty, not in the National Guard or reserves. But typically the National Guard falls under the command of the state governor. And it can be mobilized or federalized in times of emergency for use overseas. And we certainly saw a lot of that during the Iraq and Afghanistan war. We could not have done what we did without all the Guard and Reserve soldiers stepping forward to support. And then they're used domestically for crisis, disaster, crowd control, crisis being a key word. So they're not strangers to crowd control, riot control, to civil disturbance, interdiction, and have been used. And we have a history of that in this country, of them being called out to be used for different situations. Limited scope for active formations to be utilized. Elliot had his experience in New Orleans. I know that the 7th LID was called up in the Rodney King riots in LA years and years and years ago. And Elliot's right, it should be done with extreme prudence and very carefully and only when absolutely necessary. So for the Guard to be called up by the state governor to help secure the streets or secure a situation when there is domestic violence or rioting going on, that's not outside the domain, you know, whatsoever. I think right now, obviously, the what's at question is utilizing Guard forces in situations specifically where other federal agencies
ergo ICE, mm-hmm. is coming under attack daily basis. And if the impression is that local law enforcement is not allowed to or will not help secure and respond to those individuals to help them, then the president is tempted to use the guard to secure and protect those federal forces. Yeah. And that's the rub right now, and the controversy right now.
Yeah. We're going to go to break. We have another guest joining us on the other side of this break, and we're going to keep our two guests here. A lot more to talk about as we talk about military culture. Does it need to be reformed? Do its cultures and standards need to change? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, and don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here at WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, before we get back to our conversation about the military, I want to shout out an event we're hosting this Sunday, which kind of has a military connection. I'll be in Princeton, New Jersey at the Yankee Doodle Tap Room doing a live interview with a local historian to discuss Princeton's significance to the American Revolution. There will also be a walking tour after the interview. It's part of a series of events WHYY is hosting ahead of the nation's upcoming 250th anniversary. We have limited availability, so if you want to join me Sunday at 1 in Princeton, email tavern250, that's the number 250, at WHYY.org.
And now back to unpacking Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's vision for the U.S. military. In a speech last week, he blamed politically correct and DEI politics and policies for eroding the armed forces' warfighting culture. Hegseth called for stricter standards, tougher training, and the return to a warrior mentality. And some of those fitness standards, he acknowledged, may mean that women don't make it in certain roles. And here's Secretary Hegseth from last week.
But when it comes to any job that requires physical power to perform in combat, those physical standards must be high and gender neutral. If women can make it, excellent. If not, it is what it is. If that means no women qualify for some combat jobs, so be it.
We've been talking this hour with Elliot Ackerman, a Marine veteran, and retired Lieutenant Colonel Eric Stetson. Before we get back to them, we want to bring in Kyle Ann Hunter, CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and a Marine combat veteran. Kyle Ann Hunter, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere, our question of the day is, does the U.S. military need to reform its culture and standards? And we are especially interested in hearing from veterans and their families. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, put the comments in the chat. And Kyle Ann, we wanted to just get your take. You heard those comments from Secretary Hegseth. You know, it's been a week. The dust has settled. Especially when we're talking about standards, when it, you know, with women, your comments, your thoughts.
The reality is that women have been meeting these standards ever since they joined. And if we talk about combat arms, that is infantry, tanks, artillery, it was actually the opening up of these career fields to women that largely led to gender neutral physical standards. There is, if you go to infantry officer school, if you go to the school of infantry as an enlisted person, there is one standard that everyone needs to make. And it is very unfortunate that misinformation that somehow women are held to a different standard continues to perpetuate.
So this standard for combat roles is uniform. Are there different standards for other types of roles in the military? Help us understand if there's any discrepancies, any differences at all in terms of the gatekeeping for women service members and men service members?
When it comes to occupational standards, there are zero differences. You know, I was a Cobra pilot, an attack helicopter pilot by my background. I was held to the exact same standards. There wasn't a woman's way to fly a helicopter and a man's way to fly a helicopter. There was one standard that everyone was held to. The only differential of standards that exist have to do with administrative qualifications of general health and well-being. And those are both age and gender normed. They are age normed because what qualifies as a healthy 18-year-old, when we think of a 18-year-old person, regardless of their gender, what it is that they are healthy, is different than a 55-year-old in terms of just general health and well-being. And those are administrative standards that by the DOD's own instructions cannot be used to judge qualification for any occupation. And so we talk about just general health and fitness. That is something that is completely different, completely separate, is not used to determine whether or not someone is capable or qualified for an occupational standard. For occupations, they have always been gender neutral, and they should always continue to be gender neutral.
Yeah. I'd love for you, Kyle Ann, to talk about your experience in the military a little bit, because, you know, I've met women veterans before, and they talk about how tough you have to be, how hard you have to work. Can you talk about what it was like, you know, going up, trying to become combat, you know, combat ready, and what it took for you as a woman to meet those standards?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the military is hard, and it should be hard for good reason. I think that if we think about the just toughness of standards, and I'm sure your previous guests, like knowing what Elliot went through to become a infantry officer, it was hard. It was probably hard for him as a man too. I think as a woman, where things often become difficult is being a very, very small part of the minority and being otherized or tokenized and having any mistakes you might make be scrutinized at a higher level than your male peers. I mean, I remember when I was going through flight school, and actually when I had made it to the COBRA, referred to as the RAG, the replacement air group, I made some mistakes learning how to fly a COBRA, right? Nobody is born knowing how to do this perfectly. That's why they send people to school. And it was often told to me if I made a mistake, oh, see, this is why women shouldn't be doing this. This is why women don't belong here. As opposed to, you know, my male counterparts would make the exact same types of mistakes, right? Because we are all learning this, and nobody once said, oh, this is why men shouldn't be doing this. This is why we shouldn't have men in the squadron that is here. It was seen more as, oh, well, mistakes are made. We're learning. We'll give you the extra training you need to get mm-hmm. through it. And so where the differences in the difficulty level often come from is the fact that there's so few women that everything an individual woman does ends up speaking for the entirety of the
entire gender.
That doesn't happen for men.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting comment from YouTube. This is Domi R, who says, I'm a female veteran. There's no place in the military for people like Hegseth. I've been stationed with men like him. They're still scattered here and there. I hope there weren't any in D.C. last week, I think referring to Quantico. But I guess Domi doesn't come out right and say it, but do you understand where our listener is coming from there? And I think this goes beyond whether or not your mistakes are held to a different standard, and more like the way women are treated in the service. Is there something that needs to change? And by the way, is there something that already has changed that you think Hegseth might be trying to reverse here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll say personally, I was incredibly, incredibly fortunate that I did have incredible mentors, many of whom happened to be men, just because there's more men in the military, particularly in the COBRA community, than there are women, as well as peers, many of whom were men. And I look back to the past, really, you know, almost 25 years now since 9/11, where we have two decades worth of data that show that women perform as well as men, if not better than men in some cases, what's asked of them. And I think there had been a culture shift in the military that recognized women as equal peers, largely because we continued to prove ourselves. And does that mean that there were some things that were potentially changed to accommodate physiological differences? Yes. Things like ensuring that there was proper safety equipment that fit men and women, so women were actually able to perform at their highest level and not get injured. Things like reevaluating how we do anthropomorphic measures to ensure that women and men both can fit in cockpits appropriately, so we're getting the absolute best talent we can to fly combat that aviation. And I think people who served and people who recognize that pulling the absolute best and brightest from the U.S. population to serve in the military is essential were the ones who started to percolate into leadership. And unfortunately, some of these comments are undermining the incredible contributions that a whole host of diverse individuals have made to our military. And it is, you know, an unfortunate dog whistle to those who don't think that women should continue to serve.
Yeah, I just want to point out there were a number of women and women leaders in the military. One that comes to mind, Admiral Lisa Franchetti, who was fired. There were a number of people of color who were in top brass who were fired at the beginning of this administration. I just want to get your take, Kyle Ann, on what this does for the, you know, I guess for the morale of so many women and other folks who had smashed the ceilings, who had worked so hard to climb the ranks in the military, and what you think these types of remarks will do for that morale there and future retention and recruitment of women in these roles.
This is an incredible morale killer across the board, and I will say not just of women. Admiral Franchetti in particular, she's someone that I was fortunate to know and would consider a mentor of mine, and she's a sailor's sailor. She is someone who got where she got because she's exceptionally qualified, just like every other woman, every other person of color, and every other man who gets to these positions does so because the military had put processes in place to be a true meritocracy. And when things like this happen, it impacts the morale of those who are already in. It impacts the morale of those looking to be recruited potentially. You know, we talk about these big recruiting boons that we saw earlier on this year. They were largely driven by women. We look at early on in fiscal year 2025, we saw record numbers of women joining the military. And I'll say that was largely in part due to seeing leaders like Admiral Franchetti at the helm. The removal of that, you know, it's interesting now that the DoD isn't talking about its recruiting numbers anymore, isn't talking about these historic numbers of women joining. And it may be because women are choosing not to. They're opting out. They're self-selecting out, which is unfortunate because if we look at eligibility to serve, women still are much more eligible than men in many, many states due to physical fitness and academic qualifications that they have. Additionally, there's a huge morale crisis in the veteran community coming from this. We now have several women veterans we're hearing from that don't believe their service matters anymore and are trying to opt out of the services and benefits that they earned because they feel that their service is not valued.
Thank you so much. That's Kyle Ann Hunter, CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and a Marine Combat Veteran. Appreciate your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you so much.
I want to read a comment here that I think can segue us to the next part of the conversation. Here's Deborah. I'm not advocating an unfit military force. One of my questions regarding what Hegseth appears to be requiring is that it seems that there is no longer much hand-to-hand combat per se. Rather, drones are doing the destruction. Would think that one who launches the drone doesn't need to run a 5-minute mile. And I wanted to ask you about that, Eric, because I do wonder, like, at the end of the day, if someone is defusing a bomb and that's their job in the military, you just want the best dang bomb diffuser there is, whether or not they can do a pull-up, I would imagine. Same thing for someone flying a drone. Some of these more tech-advanced military jobs, whether they're combat or non-combat. And I'm just curious how you look at physical fitness standards in the next era of warfighting.
Yeah. So, well, I know the EOD community will take exception with what you just said
about bomb defusing.
Yeah, physically extremely demanding.
Okay, so that's the wrong job to pick. Got
but taking your point. And first thing is, you know, last stat I saw is at least 30% of the formation right now is women, made up of women.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And women have been serving since Margaret Corbett at Fort Washington in the Revolutionary War, where she watched her husband go down. And she picked up the ramming staff and started crewing that cannon, you know, loading it and firing it. Mm-hmm. I was given an honorary NCO commission by George Washington and known as Captain Molly after that. And she was wounded herself in the same battle. And then she succumbed at age 48. So she's one of our first American warfighters. Women have always found themselves in combat one way or another. And they've done amazing things in combat. And one of the things that Secretary Hegseth did acknowledge in his remarks and in his memo on this, which I've reviewed, is the gender-neutral standards for the combat arms groups and a next level for combat service groups in the military. And then we have combat service support. But to your question specifically, what we learned in Iraq and Afghanistan is it doesn't really matter where you are in the battlefield. You're still in the fight. There's no front.
War is everywhere.
It's everywhere. Yeah. And especially with drones now, because you could be walking across a FOB in the middle of Iraq and some mortar rounds slapped down in, and all of a sudden the buddy beside you is missing half an arm or half a leg and they're bleeding out, and you've got to get that person to an aid station.
So you're making the case that physical fitness matters maybe even more, even with all the advances in technology.
Yeah, the battlefield is everywhere, and every soldier, regardless, or ground warfighter, regardless of their MOS, can find themselves in a combat situation where they have to effectively use their weapon, effectively perform life-saving aid, effectively move and fire, and effectively do CASIVAC of people, you know, bigger and heavier than themselves. You know, I'm 175 pounds, I'm bench pressing 240, squatting whatever, and I got to move a guy who's 210 pounds before he's wearing all his body armor. Mm-hmm. It is hard, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why the emphasis is on being very physically tough, and by, especially for combat arms, meeting the standard. Don't care if you're a woman or a man, you know, you've got to be ready for that. And so I think that, you know, we are going to see warfare change dramatically, and we have to be careful that we're not looking at what's going on with drone warfare and Ukraine and whatnot and saying, well, that's what our next war will look like. It might not. But what the common denominator is the human being.
Yeah.
And so that human being has to be physically tough, mentally tough, resilient, trained, led well by qualified, capable leaders who will push them. Right. And we'll demand standards from them. And that's the fair thing to do for them so that they are ready for combat and give them the best possible chance to come home alive. And their parents deserve that. Yeah. This country deserves it. You and I as the taxpayer deserves that. And so that's why we take this so seriously in terms of unit readiness and maintaining our fitness and our standards.
Yeah. And Elliot, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation because I wanted to talk about this. I want you to comment on what Eric just said, but also this 1990 standard that Secretary Hegseth referred to. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I know a lot of changes happened right after the 1990 year that allowed more women and more people of color to move up the ranks. And he specifically wants to go back to that 1990 and before standard. Can you tell us the significance of that and what that would do to change some of the progress that has been made?
Well, I think going back to a 1990 standard, I mean, sure, you could pick your place on the timeline where you want to go back to. You know, it was a post-1990 military that just fought America's longest war. I want to talk about something Kellyanne said that I think is really important that she went by pretty quickly, is the combat standards have not changed. Mm-hmm. And what Secretary Hegseth did in his speech, and he's smart and he knows what he was doing, is he was making the inference that they had changed and conflating two things. And he is a political creature and he knows that that is rage bait for many, many people. So if you were to tell me, I'm a former Marine Raider, I came up through the recon community. If you were to tell me, and I'm pretty pro, you know, women in combat, I think, you know, the standard is the standard. If you can make it, you should be able to play. But if you were to tell me that in order to get more women into the Marine Special Operations community, we had decided to lower the standard of our training courses, I would be furious. I would be completely indignant. Or if you were to say to become a Marine infantry officer now because we had women, the infantry officer course was going to be easier, I would say absolutely not. But that is not what has happened. And like to give you evidence of that, right? Look at like naval special warfare. Do you know how many female Navy SEALs exist in the U.S. military today? Zero.
Zero. I was guessing.
Yeah, zero. Yeah,
but because none can pass BUDS. They've never been able to pass BUDS.
Yeah.
Passed through Ranger School. But it's like virtually zero. So what Hegseth is doing is saying, oh, no, those schools have all changed, which they haven't, because that makes old timers really, really upset and says, no, you have to get the standards back. So it's like the arsonist lighting the fire and saying, we got to put out the fire.
But is it your contention,
and that is inherently political?
Is it your contention, Elliot, that there's been no broader culture shift within the military? That this is a pure invention, a political invention
There's been a culture shift.
But not a standard shift.
There's been a culture shift in America since 1990, and I think it's probably for the good, and it's more inclusive. There are more women in the workforce. We are tapping into the massive pool of talent we have that is maybe female and a little bit more diverse. And like, that's great. I think one thing that's probably come into the military in the last, you know, 5 to 6 years that I think would be great to excise is a lot of the identitarianism, which has not been helpful. And that's probably a good thing to get out. But the way Hegseth has gone about this in this speech is really destructive, and it does undermine women who've been meeting the standard. Like, there are female Marine infantrymen, and they have passed through the exact same courses that male Marine infantry passed through. And I tell you, I am a Marine infantryman. Every single guy in my infantry unit was not like some Adonis chiseled out of stone Olympic athlete. You know what I mean? They just weren't.
Yeah.
Actually, I read in the article, like, my first collateral duty as a rifle platoon commander was I was my company's body composition officer, which meant once a month I had to tape and weigh all the fatties to get them closer to the standard. So these guys exist in every unit, and there are a lot of women who are much fitter than those fatties. But what Hegseth is doing is basically saying that, yes, like, in the general physical fitness test that every service member takes,
yeah,
there are different standards to have different scores, and they break down by gender and by age. So, like, I'm a 45-year-old man.
We are getting to the end here.
Score on the Marine Corps physical fitness test, I can run slower and do fewer pull-ups than a 20-year-old man.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, if you're a woman, to get the perfect score, those are different. But that is something totally different than, like, can you pass through this tough guy school?
Yeah.
And he's conflating the two. And it's for
and
a political
go.
Reason, because he knows better.
That's
he knows
Elliot. That is Elliot Ackerman, Marine veteran, retired Lieutenant Colonel. Eric Stetson has also been with us this hour. We heard from Kyle Ann Hunter. I want to thank all of you for being here today on Studio 2. Interesting conversation.
Yes, and thank you to everybody who wrote in. Lots of interesting comments online. And thanks so much to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.